Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. In about 15 minutes, Amy White from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch is going to be joining us to talk about the Republican National Convention and the war on terrorism. Some of her reflections on that convention as a corporate and political speechwriter. Very interesting conversation with her in about 15 minutes. We're talking about the worship wars with Ralph Preuss, pastor of River Heights Lutheran Church in East Grand Forks, Minnesota. There is a place where they get worship right, and they get it. They understand it. None of this nonsense about worship being for God's benefit, this pagan notion that somehow we have something to bring to God that he needs, none of that at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. They have a series of fall retreats, and the president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, Dr. Dean Wenthe, personally invites you to come and worship with the faculty there, with other Christians from around the nation, and to learn more about the nature of worship and of the church at one of their fall retreats at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. To find out more about these retreats, either visit them on the web at www.ctsfw.edu, ctsfw.edu, or call them toll-free, 1-877-287-4338, 1-877-287-4338. Ask about the fall retreats at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Pastor Preuss, sometimes we're talking about the church growth movement and its contribution to the worship war. Sometimes church growth advocates will just come out and say what they mean. And here's an example. This is a quote from George Barna from his book, Marketing the Church. He says, "It is critical that we keep in mind a fundamental principle of Christian communication. The audience, not the message, is sovereign." Is this typical of what we find in the church growth movement vis-a-vis the worship wars?
Well, that's an interesting quote. That reminds me of what they used to talk about back in the 60s. That the world sets the agenda, and I think that's implicit in the whole thing. Yes, I mean they assume that the audience will determine the agenda because they don't really believe the word itself it authenticates itself. That is, does God have the power through the word He's given us to meet the needs of people, even when they don't know what their needs are? I'd say he does.
What role, then, generally speaking, has the church growth movement, now with us, I would say, nigh on 40 years in a formal way, what role has it played in the worship wars?
Well, I think what it's done is it's shaken the confidence that traditionalists have had in the value of the historic liturgy of the church. They don't want to be legalistic and say, well, you have to worship just this way. They want to hold on to what they've had, but they cannot withstand oftentimes the extreme pressure to change, to adapt to these new demands. And so I think that it has damaged the church. It's no longer a safe place where you go and you find your home, but it is a place where there's quarreling and bickering over what you're supposed to be doing when you get there.
Someone would say, look, the solution to this is quite obvious, and that is quit fighting, quit bickering. What we need to do is let's take the laissez-faire attitude toward worship and let each man do what is right in his own eyes.
Well, the thing of it is you go into a church. Who makes the decision how the church is going to worship? In any congregation, I think any pastor with any experience would know this, that in any congregation, the vast majority of the people don't really speak up and say what they want. So even on a purely democratic level, shouldn't you just leave things well enough alone rather than deprive people of their home? And to say, well, each man do what's right in his own eyes, that means that whoever has the loudest voice or who's ever the most aggressive simply gets his way, and the others are left to with what's there. They lose what they inherited from their parents and grandparents.
Would that laissez-faire attitude toward the worship life of the church also... Could it also simply be a way of avoiding the theological questions that we've been dealing with here. What worship is, the nature of the church, how is the church created, how does the church grow?
Oh, yeah, I think it is evading the issue, because if they confronted the issue, I'm convinced that Lutherans would return to the historic liturgy. If they confronted what you just said, that they would realize, hey, I don't want to lose this. This is something very precious. Maybe I didn't appreciate its value, but now I do. And I think if they were to look at the purpose of worship, who's in charge, who is serving whom, I very much believe that they would want to hold on to the traditional church service that we've had for hundreds of years.
In the last few minutes, give us two examples, if you would, and we have no more time than that, two examples of something in the historic worship of the church that are worth retaining and that we would be less if we were to abandon them.
I'll give you two real quick. One is the so-called Sanctus, which is holy, 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 Lord God of Sabaoth, heaven and earth are full of your glory. Hosanna, Hosanna, Hosanna in the highest. Blessed is he, blessed is he, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Now, what you have there are two portions of the Bible joined together. You have Isaiah's vision, where he sees the holy God lifted up in the temple, and it terrifies him because he's a sinful man living among sinners. And then from that vision of terror at the holy God, we hear the beautiful words, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, which is Jesus riding the donkey into Jerusalem, coming to serve and to save his people. It's just such a beautiful expression of how God comes to us in a way that we don't have to flee in terror, but we can welcome him. So the Sanctus is just a theological masterpiece, and it occurs in the liturgy before the supper. And it's and the second one I would say is the Aaronic benediction, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious unto you. The Lord lift up his... The Aaronic benediction is pure gospel. It leaves you with peace. It leaves you with forgiveness. And it doesn't lay a burden on you as you leave God's house, but it leaves you with the strength of the Holy Ghost. So I would say those two things are just precious, and they shouldn't be discarded.
Now, with only 30 seconds, if there will be a resolution to the worship wars, what would be the God-pleasing resolution?
I think a God-pleasing resolution would be if folks would return to the basic biblical teaching of law and gospel. Ask, what is our greatest need? How does God meet that need in our lives? Having addressed those questions, now let's look at the traditional liturgy and see whether this isn't what we've always needed all along. Persuade people. Don't force it on them. Don't appeal to legal, you know, requirements or tradition, but just persuade them. This is what is best for you. And I think people can be persuaded because it is food for the soul. And if we just persuade people, I think it can be done.
Pastor Rolf Preuss is pastor of River Heights Lutheran Church in East Grand Forks, Minnesota, author of this essay. You can find it on christforus.org. It's called Lutheran Worship Wars. Pastor Preuss, thanks for being our guest.
Well, thank you for having me.
Earlier today, I had the opportunity to talk with Amy White from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. She's a political and corporate speechwriter. She has a column in this week's St. Louis Post-Dispatch titled Politics and Terror. I began by asking her about the Republican National Convention. These things are so tightly scripted and programmed. I began by asking her whether or not the Republican National Convention several weeks ago in New York was any exception.
Well, I do think there were a few moments that were an exception, Todd. I mean, there were a lot of signs of what careful scripting had gone on. most of the signs that you saw waved were pre-printed, even the ones that were supposed to appear, that they were hand-lettered. There were props handed out in advance, like flip-flops to be used during the speech. And everything was extremely carefully coordinated. But there were a couple moments that I thought were the most significant, and those were spontaneous, in my opinion, and they occurred during a couple of the key speeches of the convention.
The first one you mentioned is Senator John McCain. I was watching this speech on television, and John McCain is known for a rather understated delivery. Did he vary from that?
Actually, I believe he did. Through the majority of his speech, which I think was very well written, he stuck true to form in terms of being low-key and earnest. But at the very, very end, he suddenly had his voice go up in volume pretty significantly. He started to pound the podium, which I have rarely seen him do. And he began to really nearly yell his conclusion. He said, "Do not yield, do not flinch, stand up with our president and fight." And I was shocked to see at that point that he had tears in his eyes, that he was blinking very furiously to dispel. And I really thought that was a profound moment, because he had been very busy making the case that terrorists and the fight against terrorism was our greatest priority. But with that conclusion and his obvious emotion, it made clear to me that he believed that there was a possibility that perhaps we would not fight, that some of us would opt to not fight or engage in this battle. And so I thought it was a really significant, moving, profound moment.
On one of the subsequent nights of the convention, a news story broke that was genuinely horrific from the former Soviet Union. Tell us the story and how it, at least to your way of observation, served as the subtext for much of what took place after that at the Republican National Convention.
Well, we had, while the convention unfolded, we had a group of parents and children in Beslan, Russia, that woke up in the morning and headed for the first day of school, and there was a rally in honor of the first day of school, where you had several different grades represented, and most of the parents were there with their young children and other young siblings. And the gym had been rigged with explosives, and there were terrorists present who took everyone in the gym hostage. And we only found out later that there were more than 1,000 people packed into that gym with no food or water of any kind, and a tremendous amount of cruelty taking place. And as the entire convention unfolded, you could see down below, for those of us who watch the convention on cable, this crawl, this news crawl that now is an addition to so many different programs that we see, that's constantly updating what they consider to be top stories. As the convention unfolded and you're watching Zell Miller's speech and you're watching these other things at the convention, there's this relentless mention of these children being held hostage and of the police and the security and the wailing parents outside of the school waiting to see if their child or their loved one is going to emerge. And I thought that it was a really powerful and deeply distressing reminder of what really the key issues of this election, this presidential election, are.
You mentioned the earnestness of Senator John McCain in his speech, and Zell Miller, Democrat, was asked to do the keynote at the convention on his evening. Ernest hardly describes his speech. I listened to it on the radio. I was riveted.
He was impassioned, truly impassioned. And it's interesting that at the conclusion of that speech, even commentators that we have come to think of as conservative appeared absolutely shocked at how direct and impassioned and no holds barred that speech was. It appears that even though our political discourse keeps getting uglier in this country, that we have grown increasingly uncomfortable with people stating their case clearly and without a bunch of caveats. And Zell Miller stood up there, and he laid out in the very beginning of his speech that he was there for one reason and one purpose, and that was because his family was more important than his party, and that he believed George Bush was the man who could best protect his grandchildren and his great-grandchildren. And it was a pretty profound moment that I think most Americans could really clearly understand and appreciate the honesty of that assessment, because Zell Miller was not making a calculated political move trying to get a position in Bush's administration if he's reelected, or trying to earn reelection down back in Georgia, he had decided to take a stand based on a very primitive desire to keep his family safe. And I think for the majority of people who heard the speech, even for those who disliked his position, I think they could appreciate the sincerity and the passion behind it.
You observed this as a corporate and political speechwriter yourself, Amy. How did you assess that speech, and how important was it? How good of an example is that of the importance of bringing that passion and that personal tone to what is a very political venue, a party convention?
I thought it was a fabulous speech. I would have loved to have written it myself. I would have loved to have made claim of that speech because I think it was very direct. There are people who can take issues with how Zell Miller explained why he believes his own party is so interested in ousting President Bush. People can argue over that. But I don't think they can argue with the basic sincerity and honesty of someone who has spent his entire life in politics standing up and saying, I'm about to tell you the truth as I see it. And I think that so much of our political discourse now is about using shadows and mirrors, trying to use phrases that different people might interpret different ways, trying to make sure we don't alienate rather than really rising up and leading or being able to say clearly, here is what I believe is true. I think that our political rhetoric has been so weakened, and at the same time, it has become so ugly. And so I thought Zell Miller did a fabulous job, and it was interesting to hear afterwards a lot of people accuse Zell Miller of attacking John Kerry's patriotism and other so-called insults that he had delivered. When you actually look at the text, Todd, it's not there. I think what people were trying to do is they were talking about what they felt they came away with, and it shows that our listening skills continue to grow, you know, worse and worse in this country.
That has got to be an unbelievable and almost unsurmountable obstacle for someone who tries to craft public discourse like a speechwriter, when you realize that it's hard enough to deliver a speech and to get someone who has the courage to speak the words, but then on the other end, on the receiving end, the ability to hear it and listen critically to it is almost non-existent.
Well, that's exactly right, and it's very interesting to hear the debates take place. You accused me of being unpatriotic. No, I didn't. Yes, you did. No, I didn't. You know, people don't even use those old-fashioned academic skills of going back to the text. They just simply go on assumption. It doesn't matter the actual words you spoke. All that matters is the message I perceived that you gave. And so I really think that we should all be concerned that our debate on a lot of really important issues has descended to the point where there's no true debate taking place.
Now, back to the Miller speech, one more question. Had that been delivered purely as an auditory experience, without the image, without the visual image, which we are so keyed into in our culture, and people had just heard it, would that have made a difference in its impact?
Well, I believe that people tend to listen more carefully when they're not distracted by a picture. We've all grown so used to observing a picture along with the words, and our eyes really do tend to win out over our ears. So I think that people, when they're listening to something, I really picture Americans gathering around the radios to listen to FDR after December 7th, how they must have been hanging on every word and how carefully they must have been taking that in. I think that if people would have heard it, they might have come across with a better understanding of what he was talking about. But overall, I think that our listening skills are still compromised. But I do agree with you that it would have been better had some of those individuals heard the speech rather than watched it, because many people took note of the fact that Zell Miller's facial expression really didn't change from the moment he strode out on stage to the moment he departed. He walked out like a man who was really impassioned, bothered, distressed, and determined to make his case that George W. Bush should be reelected. And I think many people found themselves so riveted by his expression that they did not indeed listen very carefully.
The president's speech, you note in your column a very awkward juxtaposition of the president delivering a laundry list of basically, you know, spending priorities, while there was this news crawl on many of the networks' coverage underneath him about the Russian terrorist situation.
Right. In fact, I personally, having been following that story very closely and seeing the president walk out and begin his speech with this this very exhaustive list of different domestic initiatives for the next term, I really felt very uncomfortable with the reminder at the bottom of the screen of the children who were literally dying and talking about reforming the tax code. Not because reforming the tax code is not a noble goal, but in comparison, it's really nearly ridiculous for us to be talking about some of those initiatives, especially in that laundry list kind of fashion, with such a serious, serious thing taking place. It's really a reflection of the main goal of the Bush presidency about what is America going to do about terrorism. As the only world superpower, what are we going to do? How are we going to address it? So as a speechwriter and as a conservative, I was very relieved to see that that speech shift gears after going through those domestic initiatives and start getting into the real heart of what this election is about.
Your overall assessment of the president's acceptance speech on Thursday night at the Republican National Convention in New York?
I thought he did a good job. I would have axed out the entire first portion, and I would have expanded on his conclusions at the end. But I thought that there was something really important that took part, that took place in the speech, and I think it was apart from what had been written and prepared for him. And that was when he came near his conclusion, and he was talking about meeting some of the individual families whose loved ones had either been lost in New York on 9/11 or had been lost serving in Afghanistan or in Iraq. His face contorted over and over again, and his mouth was going around trying to continue speaking despite the desire to cry. And I think that to see someone who is frequently accused of being superficial or a cowboy or not really caring or being stubborn, to have such a glimpse of his obvious pain about the people who had been lost in this battle against terrorism, I thought was really important for the American people to see. So independent of the words that had been prepared, I think we got a glimpse of the soul of George Bush, and that it was a very important piece of information to take into the voting booth with us on November 2nd.
What did you make of, and this was the something I did not get until I got home very late in the president's speech. I put in late evenings. I was listening to most of it on the radio in the car. I walk in near the very end of it, right before the balloon drop, and I realize that he's delivering this in the round. He's literally perched atop the presidential seal in the middle of Madison Square Garden. What did you make about the visual impact of that kind of man in the middle of the people, almost down at the level of the crowd?
Well, I thought that was a fabulous idea. And actually, one of the men who came up with that idea was a former boss of mine. And so it was fun to hear him interviewed talking about how they really wanted to get a different kind of an image for the president's speech to help set apart his remarks from the remarks of other people over the four nights. So I thought it was a beautiful, powerful visual to see him in a sea of delegates, the presidential seal, a reminder about the authority he spoke with as the current president of the United States. So I thought that was just a wonderful thing. What's going to be really tough is for the people planning the conventions in 2008 to top it. And it might be that what they do is they simply duplicate it. And perhaps it will become a new tradition. Because I don't know, short of suspending someone from the ceiling, which probably wouldn't be very presidential, I don't know how you could duplicate such an effective way of communicating someone's authority, but also their accessibility to those around them.
Amy White is a corporate and political speechwriter in Oakville, author of a column in last week's St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and always delighted to read whatever she has to write there in the Dispatch, titled Politics and Terror, Can Anyone Doubt What Our Priorities Are? Thank you very much, Amy.
Thank you.
When we come back from this break, we're going to be listening to some audio from the State Department. They recently issued their annual report on not only human rights, but religious freedom around the world. One of the things we're going to be talking about, are there countries of particular concern? Stay with us.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What is the real cause of sickness, illness, and disease? What has God done, and what is God doing to restore order to our bodies, our minds, and our spirits? Can Christians expect complete healing in this life? Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for September is called Order Restored, a Biblical Interpretation of Health, Medicine, and Healing. You can order the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for September by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section. You'll find Order Restored, a Biblical Interpretation of Health, Medicine, and Healing. It's our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for September. 1-800-325-3040.
Radiometric dating. It shows a young Earth.
Answers with Ken Ham, President of the Apologetics Ministry of Answers in Genesis. Well, Ken, I thought radiometric dating was used to say the Earth is actually billions of years old.
Well, in the past few years, a group of geologists and physicists has been looking into radioactivity in the age of the Earth. These scientists make up the RATE group and are sponsored by ICR in California. Let's look at their work. When uranium decays to lead, it gives off helium. Helium, as a gas, is able to escape from the rock. Now, certain crystals called zircons, obtained by drilling into deep granite, have been dated at 1.5 billion years old. But these same zircon crystals contain more helium than expected. These zircons were then sent to a secular expert on helium diffusion. Based on the amount of helium contained in the zircon, he estimated the age of the zircon to be no older than 14,000 years, and the dates have since been refined and updated to give a date of around 6,000 years. So the age of this rock is consistent with what we'd expect from the Bible. The Earth can only be thousands of years old, not hundreds of thousands or even millions of years.
Ken Ham looks at this controversial topic of the age of the Earth in a new booklet, available free on our website. Log on to AnswersRadio.com. That's AnswersRadio.com. You'll be encouraged in your faith when you log on.
Dr. Carl Fikencher of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on why become a pastor.
Before I went to the seminary, I worked in business for a number of years, and I enjoyed very much what I was doing, but I realized that the aspects of my jobs that I appreciated the most certainly were the opportunities to be helpful and encouraging and supportive of the people who worked with me. And it was quite clear to me, without any question, that the way I could be most helpful to them was sharing the good news of Jesus Christ, their Savior. And I realized that if I became a pastor, that would be what I'd do all the time, and I would never be restricted in any way in what I could say. The help that I could bring to people that I cared about would be the help that was not just for today or tomorrow, but eternal.
To schedule an on-campus visit at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, call 1-800-481-2155. Issues Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. Bethany Lutheran is located at 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights. The Reverend Randy Emmons is the pastor. Their phone number, 618-632-6906. 632-6906. Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights. www.bethanylcms.org. Welcome back for the last 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. Earlier today, we talked with Dr. Alvin Schmidt about slavery and Islam, and lest anyone believe that these kind of issues are not present-day issues, we're going to be talking in the last 25 minutes of the program today and hearing from the State Department itself about the state of human rights, in particular religious freedom around the world. Now, slavery and religious freedom and all the other issues of human rights are big concerns. They ought to be. We live in a land of freedom and liberty and all those kind of things. We take them for granted. The vast majority of the world's population doesn't. If you live in an Islamic nation, can you exercise religious freedom? Some of those questions are going to be answered in this 25 minutes. I do invite your questions and your comments as well. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. The State Department yesterday released its annual report on international religious freedom. But before we get to the specifics on this year's report, let's hear from Secretary of State Colin Powell. Powell says that the commitment to religious freedom is a foundation stone of the United States.
America's commitment to religious liberty is older than our nation itself. The men and women who journeyed to this new world believed that one's conscience was sacred ground upon which government cannot tread. Those courageous settlers cherished religious freedom as one of many inalienable rights inherent in human nature itself, one of those rights that formed the moral foundation of all just political orders.
You know, one might say that the earliest European settlers of the New World came for that reason primarily, and that is the exercise of religious freedom. Primarily. They came for other reasons too, of course, but what probably was the straw that broke the camel's back was the lack of freedom they had to exercise their religion where they lived previously. Secretary of State Colin Powell says that religious freedom is one of the things that makes us human.
As President Bush has said, religious liberty is the first freedom of the human soul. America stands for that freedom in our own country, and we speak for that freedom throughout the world.
Powell also says that the United States has a duty to point out nations that don't respect or, in other cases, repress religious freedom.
With the release of today's report, we reaffirm the universal spirit of our nation's founding. We reaffirm that government exists to protect human rights, not to restrict them. And we stand in solidarity with people everywhere who wish to worship without coercion. Country by country, this report documents the conditions of religious freedom around the world.
So it's no coincidence here, and I think he's making his case well, it's no coincidence here that when the Constitution is laid out in the United States with those primary purposes to promote the general welfare, ensure the domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, ensure the blessings of liberty, that one of the first liberties mentioned when the Constitution's Bill of Rights is penned is religious freedom, the first among many freedoms. Finally, Secretary of State Colin Powell says that upholding religious freedom and liberty is an essential part of what it means to be an American.
This solemn duty has always defined the American character and will forever shape our purpose in the world. Defending the sacred ground of human conscience is a natural commandment to all mankind, and America will always heed this call.
I want you to think for a moment before we start into the specifics about how religious freedom is closely tied with the freedom of thought. Because religion is not only a thing of practice, but a thing of belief. What one thinks and believes, whatever it may be, is considered sacred ground. So we have the wisdom of our own Constitution, and we have 200 plus years of experience with fairly well unrestricted religious freedom here. It's made us a little bit complacent about religious freedom in our own country. It's also perhaps made us blind to the dearth of religious freedom in the rest of the world. Whether or not people can not only believe, people can believe what they want in the privacy of their own home, but whether they can act upon those beliefs with some degree of freedom. We talked a little bit earlier with Dr. Alvin Schmidt, and he commented on this, that while you may be able to believe what you want to in some Muslim countries, practicing it is another matter. Can you assemble to worship? Can you own a Bible? We're going to hear from some of the representatives of the State Department about the nations that are of greatest concern. They call them CPCs. That's countries of particular concern. Here are the specifics. This annual State Department report on religious freedom. Ambassador John Hanford, head of the State Department's Office of Religious Freedom.
We are redesignating the other five countries that were designated last year: China, North Korea, Burma, Iran, and Sudan. We are also designating three additional countries as CPCs: Eritrea, Saudi Arabia, and Vietnam.
Now, some of these we have to comment on. In fact, we should comment on all of them. China. This is a communist nation, along with North Korea, a communist nation. Certainly not known as a bastion of freedom, period, but more or less the bastion of freedom, of religious freedom, certainly not. Now, you might say communism does not provide for religious freedom, and that's obvious to everyone who's observed the world stage for a long time. But some of these countries are not communist. They aren't. Some of them have different forms of government besides communism. Some of them are Muslim nations. He mentioned Saudi Arabia and several others. We'll be talking about them. Let's begin with Saudi Arabia.
In Saudi Arabia, the government rigidly mandates religious conformity. Non-Wahhabi Sunni Muslims, as well as Shia and Sufi Muslims, face discrimination and sometimes severe restrictions on the practice of their faith. A number of leaders from these traditions have been arrested and imprisoned.
Saudi Arabia is a Muslim nation. It is a, some people call it a monarchy. Its form of government is not communistic. What restricts people's religious freedom in Saudi Arabia is not the form of government per se, but the religion, the predominant religion in that country, a religion that restricts religious freedom. Now, what the ambassador mentioned there was Muslim on Muslim discrimination. As Christians, we ought to be equally outraged and concerned when someone's religious freedom is restricted, even if they're not Christians. It is true, we'll hear about this here in just a minute, about non-Muslim religions being restricted, but our concern ought to be equal for those who are Muslims who are not allowed because of the differences between their sect and the prevailing one in Saudi Arabia or any other country to freely practice their religions as well. Ambassador Hanford says that there is no freedom to worship for non-Muslims in Saudi Arabia either.
The government prohibits public non-Muslim religious activities. Non-Muslim worshippers risk arrest, imprisonment, or deportation for engaging in religious activities that attract official attention.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt mentioned before that in Saudi Arabia, it is illegal to own a Bible. You can't even have it in the privacy of your own home. That's a pretty severe restriction on the practice of the Christian religion. And I think you would include there not only the Christian religion, but also Jews and any other religion that might crop up in Saudi Arabia. You certainly cannot proselytize there. Secretary Hanford says that state-funded Saudi clerics in mosques funded by the Saudi government sometimes preach violence.
There were frequent instances in which mosque preachers, whose salaries are paid for by the government, used violent language against non-Sunni Muslims and other religions in their sermons.
Okay, so we've got Saudi Arabia here listed, a Muslim state, not a communist state. You can understand China or North Korea, but here's Saudi Arabia, a Muslim nation that is on the list of CPCs, countries of particular concern, when the State Department looks around the world and says, how is religious freedom faring hither and yon? Saudi Arabia tops the list among their concerns. What about freedom of religion in Iraq?
Iraq has been removed from the CPC list. Iraq had been designated in the past due to the Saddam Hussein regime's repression of religious belief and practice, particularly his vicious persecution of Shia Muslims. Now that he's been removed from power and the new transitional government is working to protect religious freedom, Iraq is no longer a CPC.
Oh, that's good news. It's always good news when we can take someone off this list. And if there is one positive outcome, regardless of where you stand on the war in Iraq, whether you think it was a good idea, a bad idea, well-conceived, ill-conceived, the product of a conspiracy theory, one good outcome is that the population of Iraq now can enjoy a greater measure of religious freedom. Evidence, State Department takes Iraq off of its CPC list. What's going on in China?
In China, the government continues to repress Tibetan Buddhists, Uyghur Muslims, Catholics faithful to the Vatican, underground Protestants, and Falun Gong. Many religious believers are imprisoned for their faith, and others continue to face detention, beatings, torture, and the destruction of places of worship. Many observers believe that in recent months, China has engaged in a crackdown against some independent religious groups.
Now, China is a Marxist nation. It is a communist nation, and probably along with North Korea and several others, the last holdouts of communist ideology. It's opening up to the West. There are all sorts of other freedoms you can exercise in China. Interestingly enough, one of the holdouts in the communist-run countries, one of the freedoms that they continue to withhold from their people, when they give them all sorts of other freedoms, free market, private property, all of these kind of things, one of the things they continue to restrict is religious freedom. It's been long recognized that that has a lot to do with the freedom of thought under communism as well. What about religious freedom in another Marxist country?
In North Korea, religious freedom simply does not exist. Credible reports indicate that religious believers, particularly Christians, often face imprisonment, torture, or even execution for their faith.
You know, part of the problem with North Korea is we have a hard time figuring out what is going on there. They are a closed nation. China, we can get in and get out and look around and check around and all these kind of things, for the most part. But North Korea is, well, we used to talk about an Iron Curtain. It still exists in North Korea. Absolutely no religious freedom. And here's the situation in another, now this is a predominantly Buddhist country, 89% Buddhist, Burma.
In Burma, the regime's high level of overall repression includes severe violations of religious freedom. Some religious believers, including a number of Buddhist monks, are imprisoned, and some Christian clergy face arrest and the destruction of their churches. The government has destroyed some mosques, and Muslims face considerable discrimination, including occasional state-orchestrated or tolerated violence.
That's among the Buddhists, the people who are sitting around all the time contemplating nothingness and meditating peacefully. In an 89% Buddhist country, Burma, we have them topping and coming near the top of the list of the countries of particular concern when it comes to religious freedom, according to the State Department. Do you see a pattern emerging here? We have a Muslim nation. We have a communist nation, actually two, China and North Korea, a Buddhist nation. What about another Muslim country?
In Iran, religious minorities, including Sunni Muslims, Baha'is, Mandaeans, Jews, and Christians, face imprisonment, harassment, intimidation, and discrimination based on their religious beliefs.
Okay, there's another Muslim country. So far, the Muslims are not faring well. What about the Sudan, where Muslims also have control?
In Sudan, the government continues to attempt to impose Sharia law on non-Muslims in some parts of the country, and non-Muslims face discrimination and restrictions on the practice of their faith.
So here's the pattern again. Saudi Arabia, a Muslim country. China, a communist Marxist country. North Korea, communist. Burma is a Buddhist country. Iran is a Muslim country. The Sudan, largely a Muslim country. And in Eritrea.
In Vietnam, at least 45 religious believers remain imprisoned, including members of the Buddhist, Catholic, Protestant, Wahao, and Cao Dai faiths. Many ethnic minority Protestants have been pressured by authorities to renounce their faith, and some have been subjected to physical abuse. Hundreds of churches and places of worship in the Central Highlands have been shut down.
Okay, folks, that was Vietnam, not Eritrea. Vietnam, let me put it on the list. What about Eritrea? Let's find out what's going on there. Okay, we'll get Eritrea here in just a moment. The pattern emerges here. Now, it's not a pattern that you can say, well, it must be the communists and the Muslims. That's not what you're looking for here. Look here not so much for what the religion that is practiced or that does predominate in these countries of particular concern, but the religion that doesn't. Do you find, say, Germany on this list? No. Do you find even France or Italy on this list? Would you find the United States? No. South American countries? Not likely. What's the common denominator among them? A strong Christian influence. Now, I'm not talking here about Christian nations. I'm talking about nations that have in their history been strongly influenced by Western civilization and its Christian underpinnings. Its Christian ideology, ethos. In countries, and these are just the ones that top the list, folks. These are the worst offenders. These are the most wanted. These aren't everybody that the State Department is concerned about. In countries where Christianity has had the least influence, we find the worst records of human rights, and in particular, of religious freedom. Now, if religious freedom is, in fact, as the ambassador mentioned before, the first among all freedoms, the first among human freedoms. If that is the truth, how do you think other human rights are faring in these countries? If there isn't religious freedom or freedom of thought. I'd like your thoughts on this as well. We have a few minutes here. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Eritrea is also mentioned in the State Department's list. They are a predominantly Muslim country as well. They've got to, they've, think about it. When was the last time you heard about Eritrea? What's their gross domestic product? What do they export? You don't know anything about it. It's insignificant. It's a Muslim country, and yet it, this insignificant Muslim country tops the list of countries of particular concern. We frequently hear, don't we, how Christians are imposing their religious beliefs on everybody else. We hear it most of all here in so-called, quote-unquote, Christian America. Christians are imposing their beliefs on everyone else. Who is imposing their beliefs? In a Muslim country, let's take the communists out of it, although communism could be interpreted to be a kind of a Marxist religion. Who is imposing whose religion on who? In a Muslim country where all other viewpoints besides that of Islam are repressed through official governmental action or unofficial actions or just the force of culture, who is imposing their religious views on who? Nothing like this exists in countries where the primary influence religiously has been Christianity. I'm not saying they're Christian nations, but where the primary influence has been Christianity, nothing like this exists. I don't know that there's a lot of evidence if we look at these lists compiled by the State Department, and we could go back several years and probably find the same thing to be true. I don't think there's a lot of evidence that where Christianity holds sway in terms of influence, and not in terms of evangelism, but in terms of influence, that Christianity gets imposed on anybody. Well, let's see what the White House has to say about religious freedom. Here's White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan.
This president never hesitates to point out when countries can do more when it comes to human rights and religious tolerance. The president has made promotion of human rights, including religious freedom, a cornerstone of United States foreign policy.
Okay, I'm glad to hear it. And maybe we ought to consider more conversation about human rights and religious freedom in particular when it comes time to deal with OPEC. When it comes time to deal with Arab countries where Islam holds sway. You know, we do buy a lot of oil. That makes us a valuable friend economically of some of these Muslim countries. Not all of them. I mean, Iran doesn't have any oil to speak of, as far as I know. That makes us a valuable friend and business partner of Saudi Arabia, the one that tops the list. Maybe when we're talking with them about the price of oil, we could also talk with them about their human rights records, in particular, religious freedom. Here's Scott McClellan again. He says that the latest report on religious freedom should help offending countries do better.
This is a report that the State Department puts out every year. They look at these issues and make these determinations, and hopefully countries will take this and use it to do a better job. We take our responsibility in this area very seriously. The United States is a leader when it comes to promoting religious freedom.
So we're talking about a country, Saudi Arabia, here, that this, the State Department issues this report and they say we want them to do better. Maybe we're ignoring one big ingredient. We can talk to them about religious freedom all we want to. We can write them up on reports. Saudi Arabia, you don't get a very good grade this year from the State Department on your religious freedom, ignoring the ingredient that is perhaps most relevant here, and that is the religion that predominates in Saudi Arabia, Islam, does not permit religious freedom because there's nothing in the religion itself that would allow this. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4 that I can count, if the list is complete, Muslim countries on this list. Shortly after September 11th, President George W. Bush said, Islam is peace. I'm not asking about terrorism. I'm asking about basic religious freedom. Does the evidence exist that Islam, where it predominates politically, fosters human rights and religious freedom? So far, no. One Buddhist nation, Burma, they may be the exception. I don't know what form of government they have. What would you think if we were lumping other religions along with communism? We've got communist and predominantly Muslim nations here. Again, are we ignoring something? We know the ills of communism. Communism is atheistic. It doesn't permit religious freedom because it doesn't permit God, period. The state must be God, and since the state must be God, all of the gods and the notions of other gods must be repressed, if necessary, by force. But at least in theory, Islam is not atheistic. It's got, it has a God. What is it about this religion that seems to make it impossible for the nations where it prevails politically to permit religious freedom? I'm not asking the terrorism question. I'm just asking about a basic human right. Norm is calling from his car. Norm, welcome.
Hi, Todd. I'm just commenting on back when you were talking about Iraq and now, you know, more religious freedom. But in their new constitution, however, in one of the articles, they still designate Islam as being the official religion. And some of the Christians over there heard them talking about it. I'm a little out of breath. I was doing something else for a moment. Excuse me. But anyway, that they have a great concern about the implications of that in light, of course, of Muslim thinking about Christians. So I just wanted to put that in there.
Thank you very much, Norm. They would be well to consider whether that's a good idea. Now, it depends on what that constitution means when it says is it a Muslim nation? Do they mean that they are going to try to enact Muslim Sharia law at the level of the street? That's one thing. That would be great concern. Or would they be a Muslim nation in the sense that they're going to describe themselves as predominantly Muslims, just in a demographic sense? Those are two very, very different things. So you look at the record of these countries that top the State Department's list as offenders or countries of particular concern when it comes to religious freedom. You have three Marxists, no surprise there. One Buddhist, go figure. I thought Buddhists did a lot of meditating. Apparently, they also restrict religious rights in Burma. Four Muslim nations. Not every Muslim nation, but four Muslim nations. We talked about this yesterday. I asked the question of Tim Gagelin when I talked with him. Do you think the Bush administration is ignoring the religious ingredient in international terrorism? Maybe we ought to ask the same question of the restriction of religious freedom. Are we ignoring the religious ingredient? Is the catalyst that brings about the repression of religious views and practices not just governments and the nature of your polity, but the religion that predominates in your country? By contrast, as I said before, where Christianity in its broadest terms has held influence, and I'm talking about Western Europe, the United States, South America, Canada, yeah, we'll even throw in Canada, several other places in the country, I mean in the world, where Christianity has had an influence over time, religious freedom may not be perfect, but it flourishes. One of the things we could say to silence those in our own country who say you Christians are always about imposing your religious views on everyone else is, well, you know, that's not true. We don't impose our religious views on everyone else. But we could be living in a Muslim nation, which, according to the State Department, is almost as bad, if not worse, than living under communism. Tomorrow on Issues, Etc., a two-hour discussion with Dr. Alvin Schmidt on Islam. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.